Okay, so just introduce myself. I was working at Greater London Radio, Marylebone High Street, in the early 1990s, which is the BBC's station for London. We were in quite a unique position, really, as regards local radio, in that we had a massive audience, and also we were doing a lot of international and national stories. I worked there for about a year on the Johnny Walker programme, which was a drive-time show with the producer Mike Thompson, who's now at Radio 4. Doing some fascinating stories that very few local radio researchers ever get a chance to touch. I then went on to work in other local radio around the country, but then realised, I suppose, that nothing would be quite as good as working here in London and doing large scale. Really, radio has the first bite of the cherry. When anything happens, we can get people on the air, live, looking over the scene. For example, the London Stock Exchange bomb, which we covered. I managed to find a colleague of mine, or a friend, who worked just next to the Stock Exchange, who was giving a live commentary over the radio to the whole of London as the police were arriving at the Stock Exchange bomb, and giving his commentary, just describing the whole scene to everybody, for the entire public. And there's something I rather love about radio, is a chance to be a bit more spontaneous and genuine to your audience. And also, of course, much of what we were doing was live. It wasn't pre-recorded, messed around with, edited, etc., as so much of television is, and obviously pretty much all of print these days. So I took the whole 7-7 thing in a way quite personally when that happened, and I was really not happy with the way it was being reported. Saw a lot of flaws in what was being said, particularly the three or four different stories about what happened in the morning of that day with Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the finance minister from Israel, who was over at the time, and whether he'd actually changed his mind, not gone to the conference on the morning of 7-7, whether he'd actually gone halfway there and come back. There was all sorts of anomalies on that particular one. Also, the privatisation of security on the London Underground a few months before by Gordon Brown, and the fact that we had an Israeli firm running the CCTV systems on the London Underground, having access to all of those networks, and the fact that actually it was a former officer in the Israeli Corps of Engineers who was running that company, Daniel Bodner. You start looking into Verit, you find that their parent company was Converse Technologies, and Converse's chief executive was on the run at the time in Namibia, having absconded with, I think, $13 million, and he was being chased by the Securities and Exchange Commission. So this is not necessarily a 100% watertight, trustworthy company that was running security on the London Underground at the time of the London bombings. This kind of thing has virtually not been reported at all. The other thing is, really just picking up on what Martin was saying about the city. We actually ran a story last night on our radio program, which I do now, a two-hour politics show live every week on Fridays between 5 and 7 in Bristol. The website, if you want to jot it down, if you can be bothered, is thisweek.org.uk. We ran a piece last night about South London gangster Charlie Richardson, the Richardson brothers. They was apparently even more ruthless than the Krays. And when Charlie finally went down, I think it was for 7 years, he walked straight out of jail into a job in the city. So you can get an idea of the sort of people that are being recruited into the financial institutions in this country. Anyway, more about, this whole session is supposed to be about how things really work. And I think actually it's very simple. It's still just the way it's always been, about selfish people versus public-spirited people. Are the people who are in public positions selfish, working for their own interests, or are they working for genuinely in the interest of everybody? In the old days, it used to be very important for politicians to have credibility that they really were decent people working for the public's good. Now that seems to have gone totally out the window with Liam Fox clinging on for grim death, David Cameron clinging on to Liam for grim death, when he's clearly a compulsive liar. He's been made absolutely clear that he's lied several times in answers to questions by parliamentarians, and yet still they want to hold on to him until the very last minute. These people are clearly not public-spirited types. The Bilderberg, I suppose, is one of the things I'm best well known for. When I was living in Oxford, I did a lot of research in the Bodleian Library, drilling down into some of the origins of the Bilderberg conferences, because I was quite aware that as a journalist, that very few journalists knew about this organisation, and also I was really quite horrified to see that much of the coverage, much of the writing about it, apart from in this chap's magazine, a particular good article by Mike Peters called Bilderberg and the Project for European Unification, was from the far right, and really discredited a lot of the good information that there was about the Bilderbergers, and it seemed to be a very tainted area. So I thought, well, let's get my journalistic teeth into this. One of the things that I dug out was that there were quite a lot of connections with Freemasonry, particularly the guy that started it, Joseph Rettinger, a Polish bloke who was working for MI6. He was one of the people that created it, and it's quite clear he was a Freemason. In fact, in Polish now, there is quite a lot of work going on in the Polish language in looking into Rettinger, as the Poles realised what important figure he was. Another chap involved in the Bilderbergs, who was a Freemason, is the last person that organised a conference in Britain, which is Andrew Palmer. He was also, he organised the Turnberry Conference in 1998. He, for some reason, put his CV on the internet, or was on one of these article search services, and someone sent it to me, his Palmer's CV. He was the PA to the Duke of Kent, who's the chief of, or the Grand Master, in fact, of the Scottish Rite and World Freemasonry based in Covent Garden here. So obviously there's quite a close connection there. The other thing is Carrington as well, is there's a lot of evidence that he's a Mason, certainly absolutely cast iron evidence that his father was a Freemason, and Peter Carrington was the chairman of the Bilderbergs. Just a quick introduction for people that aren't necessarily very familiar with who the Bilderbergers are. They were created back in 1954 by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was in the SS in the run-up to the Second World War. He was one of the first people to join the SS, in fact, a very enthusiastic member at the time. And he was the first chairman, and he convened with Rettinger the very first meeting in 1954 in Oosterbeek in Holland, in his own hotel. It was Bernhard's hotel, called the Bilderberg Hotel, which is where the organisation gets its name from. And it's very closely connected with NATO at all levels. It seems that only people from the NATO countries ever get invited to the Bilderberg conferences. Except this year, the Chinese have been. But this is very much connected with NATO. And Thierry Masson at Voltaire Network did a fantastic article this year, just in the run-up to the Bilderberg conference, joining all those dots between NATO and the Bilderbergers. Another thing which is really, which blew my mind when I first realised it about NATO was that, I mean, we're facing all these horrible situations now with NATO getting interventionist. It's the North Atlantic Treaty Organisation. The treaty is there to defend North Atlantic countries from attack from other places. What they've gone now, because we've got peace, NATO is looking for something to do, and it seems to be kicking around the world looking for trouble. The latest intervention in Libya is just another one. It's following on from Afghanistan, Serbia, Kosovo. But at the beginning of NATO, how did it start? One of the most interesting people on this is a guy called Paul Hauser. He was a Übersturmführer in charge of an SS Panzer Corps in the Second World War. Hitler had promoted him towards the end of the war. He was in charge of, you know, loads of these SS tank divisions. And he said that the original meetings of NATO, this is a quote from Hauser, were formed from the international supporters of the SS. That's a quote from Hauser's own mouth. This is a senior SS armoured corps officer. So there are questions about NATO and its motives right from the start, if we drill down and find them. Also, I think there's been changes in Freemasonry. It's really important to understand that the character of Freemasonry in this country has changed much more to the more atheistic Grand Orient style, which was prevalent in Italy and in France. And you cannot talk about all this stuff without mentioning the good old Illuminati. Now, I don't think that the Illuminati is necessarily operating today in any kind of form, but it's important to understand, if you go back to the late 1700s, you can see exactly what they were up to within Freemasonry. And I would suggest the best source on this is John Robison's book. And Robison was a Freemason himself, and he was disgusted to see the way that this new organisation, the Illuminati, was taking over his beloved Freemasonry. So he wrote a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe in 1793, exposing the destruction of the organisation that he loved. He was a close personal friend of James Watt, who was the inventor of the steam engine. Robison was also the secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh. So I think we can see, at least the way I think this works, is through cults, ultimately. Obviously, not Freemasons aren't the only cults out there. We've got Scientologists, we've got Jehovah's Witnesses, we've got all sorts of weird cults. But this is how I think the selfish dress themselves up to be public-spirited through the whole sort of cult system. On the positive side, if you can find any in all of this, I like to look at J.R.R. Tolkien, actually, funnily enough, as his picture of the world we see now has some very powerful symbols which relate, I think, to this cult of Freemasonry angle. One is the Eye of Sauron in those films. Seems to me to look like very much like this kind of Illuminati eye, you know, the eye in the pyramid style thing. And then you've got Saruman. He's supposed to be a good guy, he's a wizard, but he throws his lot in with the forces of darkness. He betrays all his fellow humans and becomes an evil wizard. Tolkien used for him is the White Hand. Now, if you ever go anywhere near the Freemasons, you will see they all put these little white gloves on as they go into the lodge. And everything they do has got white gloves. So the White Hand, I think, is a symbol for Freemasonry. And the nice message, of course, in The Lord of the Rings is that the little guy triumphs. The small people can win over what seems like impossible odds. And actually, I think that's one of the things that we have a spirit in this country, is we like to see the little guys triumph over the big guys, despite the fact that these people have fantastic amounts of power in this secret government, and the Charlie Richardsons of this world now in the city. Actually, I think we will triumph over them, ultimately. I don't think there's any real doubt about that. They think that they've got it, but the thing is that they believe far too much of their own propaganda. So thanks for listening to me.